This episode is brought to you by The Manor, a premier addiction treatment facility in the hills of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest. Their program offers a tailored approach to those struggling with addiction in a secluded setting with no more than 11 men and women. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantal Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love are struggling with addiction, call The Manor at 414-930-1930. You can learn more about The Manor by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting discoverthemanor.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Anthony Gebert, and this is The Path to Authenticity. From the Drift, number 14. The landlocked don't understand. The coasts give us hope. The shoreline emerges in layers. Blue horizon, dark sea, white sands. More edge than place. Eventually, everything returns. The sea reclaims as much as she gives up. Wind and swell split the waves, cleaves the ocean into juggling light and dark froth. The bursting surge siphons salt and sand back from the edge. The oceans are ungovernable, a boundary with no fixed boundaries. Go there. Go to the sea. Walk out past the tidal flats and stand in the surf, in the cusp of change. If you can learn to live there, on the edge, exposed to round sky and cool earth, just a meandering vessel, distinct yet unknown, you will understand the intimacy of the drift. You will walk with the evening tides, self-illuminated.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry. And this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 153 for December 7th, 2021. This episode features a conversation with the poet Anthony Gebert. It's another of the early episodes that I did. And I thought, you know, with the passing of Robert Bly a couple weeks ago, I wanted to highlight these episodes with poets that I've done. So, this is an interesting conversation. You just heard a reading from Anthony, and you'll hear a couple more throughout the episode. If you're interested, I'm doing this January journaling challenge. You can learn more about it through the link in the show notes. For each day in the month of January, I'll provide you with a journaling prompt. Just a way to connect with you guys. And maybe start off 2022 on a high note. As I record this, it's just a couple days since we buried my mom. Just got back to Florida late last night. And it was a long week, but a good week to reconnect with my siblings. It was a beautiful service that they had for her. And I just feel extraordinarily lucky to have had such a great mom. As you might have noticed, I re-released the Mother's Day episode that I did with her. So if you haven't checked it out already, please give a listen. And if you like that or any of the episodes I've done, please leave a rating or a review at Apple Podcasts. Every little bit helps. All right, here we go. Anthony Guibert.
Notes from the Drift, number 28. Once we were wilderness people, grand nomads in search of wet clouds and green forests. Once we were rhizomatic, uncentered, a network of roots and branches provoking new paths and new becomings. Once we were fluid, soft, and far more analog. It started with the gear and the cog, the repetition of notches and edges that made life uniform, balanced, and predictable. Though the belt, the axle, and the wheel are equally suspect, the true felon is the digital. The gate and the switch, the parade of bits that pixelated our world with approximations. The Sunday polyester crowd dreams itself from Africa to the stars, from man to machine. They've appraised and rated us, data farmed, sorted, packaged, and filed. We eat off our screens the sterile delirium from which we are reborn, approximated citizens. Our machine is a false generosity, the tool that became the promise of luxury, an expected ease we've all become entitled to. The machine lacks the mysterious function of spontaneity. Its promise is the predictable, all rhythm, no riffs. A confluence of grand grooves and microcosmic improvisations, the drift makes no such promise. It moves without moving and rests without resting. Once we were grand nomads, moving in time with the drift. Though we no longer practice the old ways, we're still closer than we realize.
At this point in my life, I spend my time, about 50% of my time is taken up writing, and about the other 50% is taken up teaching college. I teach writing at the local college. So I'm split between those two endeavors, primarily. I've got a few other new projects in the works that have been taking up a lot of my time lately. Thinking about an audio podcast, same time that I'm working on two new books. So that's where most of my time is being taken up right now. And then, you know, the family life, you know, my wife, my kids, you know, life and, you know, it being in a group dynamic.
Yeah. How many children?
I have two stepsons.
Okay. How old?
19 and 21.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's a, I have a 13-year-old son. So, you know, it's just the parenting is vastly different from one age to another. It really is. And, you know, I imagine that, I'm just imagining what 19 or 21 will be like for me and my son. A little more autonomy. And, you know, it's probably, you know, I know for me at that age, I became, more engaged with my dad in more of a social way, you know, where, you know, he began to become more of a peer. So that's an interesting time of life too.
They're not kids anymore. They're in that stage of shedding childhood.
Yes.
And at the same time, they're trying to negotiate manhood, which is, you know, in this day and age, a little difficult.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
We're lucky in the sense that both of them are driven and directed and they know where they're going. So yeah, we're feeling pretty good about, you know, them in general, but you know, they're still young people and, in my book, they're just starting to get interesting. And I tell them that all the time. So this would be a shocker.
Yeah. Well, you know, just listening to you talk, you're obviously a writer,
because, you know, your verbs are, that's what stood out to me most about what I read in your book is your choice of verbs are just, you know, phenomenal. And, being a writer myself, you know, that's what I was always taught is, you know, that's the best writing always has good verbs. And, you know, I really did, appreciate your book, Notes from the Drift. And, you know, I guess you'd describe yourself as a poet. Is that accurate?
I don't consider myself a poet strictly anymore. I spent my first couple of books are poetry. I purposely wrote this book in prose because the majority of people don't really read poetry.
Yeah.
And it's sad. I mean, I still enjoy poetry, but when I came down to the things that I wanted to say in this book, I really wanted it to be read and I didn't want it to have the stigma of being poetic or academic. So what I tried to do is just write the poetry into the prose. People have called it prose poetry. I think it fits more into the genre of creative nonfiction. I think is a better title for it. So I'm going to stick with that for now. But I've been doing this since I published my first book when I was 19.
Wow.
So yeah, it's been, I mean, it's a small collection of poems, but I've been doing this a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to say it reads like poetry, but it reads like prose too, you know? So I think you accomplished your objective there. Definitely. Because, you know, to me, you know, poetry is condensed language and it definitely has that aspect, you know, where there's each one of these readings, it's just packed with, really interesting thoughts, you know, I started going through this book with a pen, which I don't always do, but I almost never do it. Actually, I wanted to do it with this and, you know, again, just the verbs and, I love it. I really do. You know, I know a little bit about poetry. I've had some creative writing classes over the years. But I'm, you know, it's not really, I definitely see what you mean about the stigma of poetry. A lot of people, it's just kind of a head in the clouds sort of thing. And, it takes kind of a certain personality to go there, I think.
And it's set.
Yeah.
Set. When you consider some of our greatest poets have also been our greatest political speakers and our greatest social critics, to have an entire segment of the population lose a taste for poetry because, you know, maybe it wasn't taught the right way in high school or maybe it was socially stigma, you know, had a social stigma attached to it because of whatever, you know, click you were in, whatever it was. I think that's sad that we've lost that. You know, it seems to me more and more poetry is getting split between this academic poetry that only other poets read and kind of the spoken word street poetry, which is, you know, a little self-aggrandizing at times and starting to sound like you can hear certain traditions are now being repeated and a lot of it is starting to sound the same because they're mimicking the same four or five major spoken word writing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not very exciting for me. It was, you know, 20 years ago, but not so much right now. So I was looking to do something different with this book and the style, you know, style, philosophy, ideas, you know, how is it going to tie all these threads together? And I experimented with a few different ways, but when I hit on this, the condensed language, the written straight up prose, I left all of the foreign language out of it. I made it extremely accessible to people. And yet I made it artistic. And that was the point of trying to tie it all together so that it became accessible to a wider group of people. And so far, knock on wood, I've been enjoying some success with it.
That's great. That's great. Well, you know, you mentioned the poets who were political figures and social commentators. You know, as I read I hear Whitman, you know, that's what comes up for me when I first started to read this. And I think part of it's the voice. Part of it is that you talk about, the earth so much, you know, there's something really earthy about what you're writing. And would you mind, for the audience, if you're comfortable, what is the drift? What, in your words, what is the drift?
Wow. So the simplest way to think about the drift is to think about it as the Tao. The idea that there is a pattern and an energy that organizes and moves the world, moves all of reality, really. So the drift is synonymous with the Tao, but what I was trying to do was search for a word that didn't tie me to the Taoist religion, but a word that would actually fit more of the experience of how I was living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I consider myself philosophically Taoist and spiritually Buddhist. So I'm splitting the two there. So philosophically, the idea of movement and flow and the transition of subtle energies, how do you write all of those things into everyday language in a way that people could pick up on it? And what I decided was I really needed a word. And the word the drift has been kicking around my psyche probably since I was about 19, and one of my early martial arts teachers described it to me as the dividing line between the yin and the yang. He called it the drift. And I've never been able to find anybody else who used that reference. But the word stuck with me. And over time I started to realize that there is this between solid and movement, between fixed positions and movement, I should say, between open and closed, between conformity and novelty, there is the drift of moving back and forth, and that's how all of reality moves. So that's where the idea of the drift comes from. My first book was actually called Drift. This was a returning to those early ideas that I tried to tackle in poetry that I just didn't have the language or the wisdom to really fully express, and coming back at it at 50.
So you mentioned martial arts. So you began studying martial arts at a fairly young age?
About the age of 12, I started studying judo. My stepfather had trained in judo in New York, and then had taught, he taught in Japan after the Korean War. So, you know, we had a rich tradition in our family of judo. And then from judo, I moved into Aikido. And then injured my back in a car accident and discovered Tai Chi. From Tai Chi, I discovered Qigong. And about the time I got into Qigong, I was just getting into Taoism and kind of let the martial world slip aside. As a friend of mine points out, there are no ninjas at the supermarket.
Okay. Yeah. Not that we know of, anyway. I mean, you know, maybe they are in somewhere hidden in a corner, but we don't see them.
Not looking for me.
Yeah. So at what point did it kind of turn more spiritual for you?
I think it's always been spiritual. I found Buddhism before I found the martial arts. My first experience with Buddhism when I was a kid, probably about 6 or 7, my grandfather owned in Riverhead, New York, and it was right there on the river that splits Long Island at the tail end. And somehow somebody owed him money and he traded for an Encyclopedia Britannica. Mm. This was given to me. And there was a hand-drawn image from some archaeologist of the face of the of Gautama Buddha. And I used to illustrate a lot when I was younger, and I just started drawing that face over and over again and became very captivated by the image, started reading, started thinking. I would say probably by the time I was 12, I was self-identifying as Buddhist. By the time I hit my latter teens, I was going to Zendos, sitting with Buddhist teachers, and, you know, and of course, Japanese martial arts is all, you know, riddled with Buddhists, right. Buddhism, who fit very well together.
So you grew up in New York City?
I grew up on the east end of Long Island, but okay. I spent moving between Brooklyn and, you know, Long Island.
So, you know, I'm a guy, I grew up in central Indiana, and there Buddhism wasn't really an option. You know, there weren't places. It's fascinating to me that at 12 years old, you already identified as Buddhist, and that you were showing up at temples in your teens. That's now, did your family have a religious orientation?
My family was, I was raised Roman Catholic, and the agreement was that I went as far as my confirmation because that would ensure me getting into heaven, and then I could do whatever I wanted.
Right.
So the last couple of years were a little dicey with, you know, me asking questions that were inappropriate. But what I found was, as I got older, priests became my friends.
Right.
Able to have dialogues. I was reading Thomas Merton and his between, you know, Catholicism and Buddhism, and I was able to hold those conversations with certain priests. You know, back in the 70s, priests were a lot more liberal than they are today. So that was that interfaith conversation was there. And there was no hard feelings as far as I knew of, you know, me moving on and going to explore other things.
Well, that definitely wouldn't be true in every Catholic family now, would it? I mean, that there wouldn't be any animosity about a son facing east, you know, the Buddhist. Wait, Buddhism.
Steal that line from you, a son facing east.
Yeah. You're going to steal it? You like that? I thought of it right here. No, I was raised Catholic too, but and I never have really studied martial arts. I had friends who did, but I have become fascinated with Buddhism over the years, and have gradually begun to you know, investigate a little bit more here and there. And I started practicing yoga a few years ago, and, you know, Eastern thought really kind of works for me, you know? And I feel like Western culture, you know, we can really benefit a lot from the lessons that the East has to teach us, that, you know, I wish more people in our part of the world were open to, I guess. You know, when you look at the, you know, when you look at the Dalai Lama and the peace that he has, I mean, it's definitely something that's missing, you know, and we're so materialistic in our culture, and, you know, and I'm a guy, you know, I work in the addiction treatment industry and have been in that world for a long time. So, you know, I see suffering up close.
Yeah.
And I am in touch with my own suffering, you know, which I believe enables me to show up for other people. But, you know, to come from a faith where it's basically, built on that premise that we suffer, we all suffer. And, what do we do with that? You know, it's, I just, you know, I like it. It really does kind of speak to me in a big way. So that's another reason why I was looking forward to talking to you. You know, I always like to learn, but, so Who would you say as a writer, who were your influences? We know where you're coming from spiritually. What about from a writing standpoint?
Early on, what fascinated me with writing was the work of Cahil Gibran.
Okay.
Be able to say so much in a short space, have such impactful stories that made you to come back and want to reread them over and over again. I told one of my early writing teachers, if I could be half as successful as Cahil Gibran, and he looked at me, he goes, well, if we could all be half as successful.
Right.
So I would say from there, moving forward. Okay. So early, I'd say definitely Gibran, Whitman. There was no escaping Walt Whitman if you grew up on Long Island.
Yeah, I imagine.
So, I mean, I spent a long time not liking Walt Whitman because my English teachers in high school would jam him down my throat and I didn't get it. Mm. But when I got, really started to enjoy Whitman. From there, wow. I grew up in my 20s, became involved in the Long Island writers community, and that made a lot of difference for me. So there's a lot of writers in there who were mentors, who influenced me that a lot of people haven't heard of. My mentor, Vince Clemente, was a local Italian-American writer who, I would say was known nationally as a biographer. He did the biography on John Ciardi. Influenced me greatly. Dave Axelrod, who was a local writer from Massachusetts who had resettled on Long Island, who now actually lives in Florida. Shout out to Dave up in Daytona. Dave was a big influence in terms of seeing how where Vince was very much the Catholic Italian American writer. David was a little bit more Eastern influenced. He had studied early on with Alan Watts at Boston. So David opened me up to, you know, what's the interplay between poetry and philosophy? And then people like Alan Plans, who was the best sea poet in America. Dan Murray, who, I would Dave was probably a B-level beat poet. All of these people were involved in the community that I was in my 20s, and a lot of them influenced me. So Vince had me reading, you know, turned me on to John Ciardi. I read his translation of Dante. I ended up reading 7 translations of Dante. I ended up studying with the Charles Matz, who is the Long Island University Dante scholar. Charles was one of the early shout poetry performers in Italy, and that's the really where spoken word comes from, early 60s shout poetry. So, you know, a lot of these influences, against the bigger drop of these local influences against the bigger drop of world writers who I was sampling everybody, you know, I can't say who influenced me more than others. Jim Harrison as a poet, was a big influence. Trying to think of who else. Believe it or not, I'd say recently I've been very fascinated by the writing of Seth Godin because he has found a way of compacting information into very readable chunks. He caught a lot of the idea for Notes from the Drift came from reading his books, where you could literally sit down and read a chapter and then think about it for a while and move on. I wanted that effect. So I'd say his writing, not artistically, but stylistically, influenced this book a bit.
I'm not familiar with him. I need to check him out.
Seth Godin is somebody I think everybody should check out. He was one of the early founders of Yahoo and went on to do some very influential work in changing the way business is done in America. So he's not a creative writer, but he is an extremely creative human being.
Yeah. And yeah, I'd heard his name and, Yeah. You know, so religion has, you know, been this major theme in your life, or spirituality, probably more precisely, right? I mean, I mean, at what point did it hit you of the level of importance that that has played in your life? And did you kind of at some point kind of own it? This is where I'm going.
It's, you know, it's hard to really say, is there a point where I can say consciously did? I can say now I own it. Right. I'm not sure where in the spectrum I can consciously say, yes, I'm a spiritual human being. I think one of the hallmarks would have been when I decided to leave the martial arts altogether. And that was a combination of events that, it led me to a place where I didn't want to be having to do things I didn't want to really do, and me just deciding I'm not going to be in this world anymore because I'm not going to embody this energy because this energy attracts like energy.
Hmm.
So I mean, it's cryptic and extremely vague, and I'm sorry to your readers, but I really don't want to go into it. It's a little personal. I don't really want to go into it, but needless to say, I got into one of those places where, you know, if you train your whole life not to fight and then you have to, that stains you in a certain way. And I didn't like the stain when I was done.
Hmm. Wow. I could talk to you forever. I love this. So at what point did you know you were going to write?
Oh, I've been writing since I was 9th grade in high school. I wrote a poem in my English class, and it kind of stuck with me. So I've been writing poetry, you know, since then. I got stuff published in the school journal and then moved on to college to get stuff published. And even when I wasn't thinking of being a college professor and I was thinking more that I might go into graphic design and marketing, which I've bounced in and out of throughout my life, I still was writing poetry. I think there is there's something to be said for not all poets have to be college professors.
You know? Right, right.
Think of Dana Gioia, who is an American poet who was head of the NEA for a while, who came out of big business. I mean, he was president of a Fortune 500 company. I met him at a workshop in the probably mid-90s and didn't take the workshop with him, but sat with him in between two of his speaking engagements and just talked to him about the time that my second book was coming out, and just was fascinated by the sense that here was a guy who did not make his living in the, in the academy. He mm-hmm. made his, you know, and then wrote poetry at home. So I think, in that sense, poetry is very much, I've always seen myself as a writer. I never stopped. I think it's been definitely highs and lows in my life, and times when I've stepped away from writing, and times when I wrote, you know, I was publishing every week, you know, so it is very much a rhythm.
Hmm. Yeah, that's something that for me I've had a little bit different experience with that. You know, I think I've always to some degree seen myself as a writer, but there have been many years of my life when I had a lot of self-imposed guilt for not writing more. And, you know, I've always kind of known there's a book. You know, I know, had a pretty good idea of what I didn't want it to be, but I wasn't sure what I did want it to be. And, you know, I finally got to a point a few years back where I just realized, you know, I haven't written the book yet because I haven't been ready to write the book I'm supposed to write yet.
Yeah.
And when I'm ready, I will write it. And, you know, now I'm at a place where the picture is getting clearer every day, you know, and I'm actually working on it and know where I'm going and, you know, have a much clearer vision. But that's been a little bit of an emotional struggle for me to have a good handle on that part of my identity, I guess, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think you know, one of the things that you've talked about here that I would have liked to have had a little bit more of an experience like you've had. You had a circle of writers around you as you were a young adult, people who were doing it all the time. And I think there's a lot to be said for, to being surrounded by people who are doing what you want to do. And it conveys a message to you that this is possible.
Yep.
You know, and for me, you know, I grew up in a factory town in central Indiana. You know, there weren't any poets, you know, I mean, and I kind of came up through journalism. There were, you know, there were sports writers. I mean, there were some of those, but it was, you know, it wasn't New York. Yeah. So, and in terms of, but something you mentioned about, you know, the writers who have had a career outside of academia and then have gone back to writing. I feel like maybe the fact that I haven't been writing this entire time or being published constantly this entire time, and I've been out living life, having experiences, doing different, I'm engaged in the world. And so then now I have these things to bring to the page, you know, which I think is, there's a lot to be said for that too.
Yeah. I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, I get it like tonight when I sat down to, I sat down to write notes from the drift and I started figuring out how I was going to do it. And I started off with, you know, okay, so stylistically, what is this going to look like? And why am I doing this? And what it was really, I wanted to see after all these years, I started at 6 months before my 50th birthday. And I wanted to say, just after all these years, what have I actually learned? What were the experiences that I had that were meaningful? What were the experiences I had that translated some sense of wisdom of authenticity to me? And then I had to sit down and start doing that. And a lot of that was digging through journals. You know, I always journal. I journal mm-hmm. every, you know, I've always cataloging my ideas and cataloging places I've been and, you know, all of that. But I had to go back to that, and it was literally a pile about 4 feet high of past journals that I was just digging through and taking sections out of and then rewriting and putting all of that together. But even then, I realized when I got about half of the book done that I couldn't have written this book any other time in my life, that this book was a product of who I am right now. And a lot of times as writers, that's just it. You know, we are ever evolving, ever growing, learning, seeing, processing, changing. And the book that we write at any given time is the book that we are ready to write at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat yourself up for not doing it if you're not there.
Right, right. Well, you can, but it's not going to get you anywhere.
It's not exactly the healthiest thing we can
do. Right, right.
Yeah.
So you teach all the time writing. What aspects of writing are you teaching? Workshops? Are you teaching creative writing? Are you teaching lit?
Right now I'm teaching basic writing, composition, essay research. Mm-hmm. That's what the college needs. The local college that I work for is, you know, I mean, it's a middle America college, enjoyable place. I like the people. My wife works there, but at the same time, in terms of that practical community college environment, creative writing is not one of the big things like it was when I was a student, you know, when I was at Suffolk Community College back in the 80s. We had a very rich writing community at the college, you know, there were a lot of professors. I think of, you know, not only I met Vince Clemente in Dave Axelrod there, but I also met Tony DeFranco, who had just won the O. Henry Award, was my composition teacher. So those people were in, you know, the idea of an English department had much more creative elements to it. Everybody writing. Maury Dean, who was my communications professor, wrote the history of rock and roll for Motown.
Wow.
You know, Yeah. So, I mean, they were all involved in working. And now most of us, I hate to say it, and God, I hope this doesn't get me in trouble with the college, but we're doing bread and butter work. We're teaching people how to write. We're taking care of problems that were not handled in high school. We are, we're teaching people to be practical writers, and there's really not a lot of interest in creative writing. So I'm sad about that, but at the same time, I look at this as just, you know, it's another wrinkle in the life of a writing instructor that, you know, this is what it is now. And I'm hoping at some point it'll come back and change, or, you know, maybe I'll move on to a different college at some point that handles these things a bit differently. I'm not really sure. Right now, where I'm at is great for me.
So, what has been, I mean, I'm thinking about, you went to college in the 80s. So, you know, I know I went to high school in the 80s and I remember having an email account. But everything was in DOS. It was pre-internet, really. And, you know, and one of the things that has kind of driven me crazy about, the advent of the internet is, you know, so many people have a platform.
Oh, yeah.
And, a lot of them don't know how to write, you know, or don't write well, I should say, or, don't write the way I was taught to write, but they still have a platform. And I don't know. I mean, I wonder, you know, and we talked earlier about poetry not being as, consumed as it was, you know, 50 years ago. Do you feel like we're dumbing things down? I mean, do you ever think so? As a culture?
Yes, I do. I do feel that, I've been involved lately with a lot of content creation and feeling that we do have to, dumb down is the wrong word. We have to simplify things for mass consumption.
Right.
You know, am I sad about the fact that people can't read, more, you know, take more in or read or have more time to read. I think if they had more time, if we were all less bipolar, you know, we could maybe this. I don't know. I mean, right now, I know the digital sales for my book have outpaced print sales. Mm. People are reading. And as you pointed out before, my book is dense. So it's, people are reading heavy material digitally. I think the bigger problem that we're facing is we're looking at a global change in the way people process information, and nobody's really taking into consideration that this was created by writers. So, you know, whatever side of the political platform or spectrum you want to be on, you know, everybody believes fake news is out there, whether you're creating it on the right or the left, but nobody really thinks about the fact that somebody is paying these kids in the Ukraine to write in English and change the world.
Right.
That's powerful. When you really start to think about it, there's some tremendous power in the idea that you can write and publish and change the world. Now, what's lacking is probably what's lacking in our society overall is a sense of ethics and morality that govern the power behind the pen.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, it's not the platform. It's not the platform. It's not the writer. It's the morality that you bring to the art, and that, yeah, that's a failure overall, as far as I'm concerned. That's a kind of a raw nerve for me because I see there's a lot of power for writers right now, and I see so few of them actually educating themselves and learning how to really move people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because they don't understand it, because they really don't understand the way language works, they become susceptible to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at that kid this weekend who shot up the Walmart. I mean, just the fact that he went and decided, I believe I'm getting this the right way, was he published a manifesto beforehand. So he understood the power of language, but he had no real critical thinking behind that, because all he was doing was mimicking stuff that other pundits have said. You know, where was his original ideas? Where was his original thought? Where was his original wisdom? You know, could he find it, or was he just inundated by other people's power? That scares me. That scares me a lot, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a lot of that. One of the things that I love about my upbringing, you know, it wasn't perfect. But I had good parents, and one of the things I valued the most about them is they taught me to think for myself, you know, and, I see, you know, and the subject matter of this podcast and the other work that I do, a lot of it's about, you know, the power of one's identity, you know, because I see so many people who don't even develop one. Mm-hmm. They just take on someone else's, you know, whether it's a parent or someone of influence in their surroundings. I mean, but, you know, a lot of times, and I think it comes through, especially in politics, that the beliefs that people are professing, I mean, if they really search their hearts, I don't even think that they believe, you know, I mean, they're just parroting something from someone else. And, you know, and the other thing that drives me crazy about all of it is the context. Like, okay, we're reading all these little bits of news all the time, but who's standing 1,000 feet above and looking down at the whole picture, which, you know, what you were just talking about is we're off course. Ethically, you know, and there's this power that we're tapping into, but what are we doing with it? You know, so it doesn't surprise me at all that it strikes a nerve with you. You know, that power is being misused or not acknowledged properly or whatever, when you've spent your life harnessing it, I guess. I mean, from, you know where you are from a moral and ethical standpoint, and your writing is steeped in that, right? I mean,
it was a hard won battle, believe me. Like anybody, you know, I had to dig myself out of middle America, I had to dig myself out of suburban Long Island. Not to say that those things are bad, but you know, that search for authenticity, you know, to tie it into the podcast, our authentic self, our true self, our original self, what does that mean? I think a lot of people, I don't even know how to get into this, but, you know, we're all so frightened, Tom, you know, the world is so frightened that even the idea of being self-actualized is a luxury. Yeah. And, you know, and then you have people out there who are spiritual teachers, and I see this a lot. You know, the spiritual teachers or the martial arts teachers who tell their students X, and the students believe X, and they believe it dogmatically, and that's all that there is, and they never see beyond that, and they never get to that place where, you know, to realize one's own authenticity is to realize we live in a very inhuman world. The majority of the world is not human, you know, and we can't even approach that idea of seeing, you know, in an inhuman way. Now, I'm not talking about inhuman as in something bad, but other than us.
Right.
We can't even get back to that original state where we see ourselves as, you know, being one of many beings existing on a planet.
Right.
Where we're all the living surface of that planet, you know, all of us together.
Right.
We most average person can't even approach that idea or that concept because they're mired in fear and concern, the future, the past, You know, do I have everything that the TV tells me I'm supposed to have? You know, am I following the right person? Am I going to the right yoga class? You know, right. I mean, it just gets out of control, and it's all levels of interference with our authentic self. It's all levels of this static and that static taking us away from what we truly are. And that, I have to say, on a daily basis is something that, you know, I have been, especially being, you know, being among younger people, have heard things that have just made me openly weep, you know, like, wow, you're in so much pain, you know, and there's nothing, you know, nothing I can do to, you know, solve that problem. That's a problem that's beyond me. It's, you know, for each of us to go down that path. I've been thinking a lot about R.D. Lang lately. You know, you're a psychologist, so you know R.D. Lang, the Scottish psychologist.
I don't. I'm not a psychologist, but you know, I'm
a therapist.
I'm a counselor. I'm an addiction counselor. So R.D., or I've heard the name.
R.D. Lang is somebody to look up. His what was the name of the book? Was it The Politics of Identity? That's it. Okay. Or, yeah, I can get back to you with it. I don't remember the name of the book. I have ran across a notebook a few years ago, and he had this idea of being, what was the term that he used? Hypersane.
Hypersane.
Hypersane. That and he talked about people like Jane Goodall, you know, and
right.
Carl Jung, you know, so the path that they took from, you know, having mental difficulties into the hyper sense of awareness and sanity. And, you know, I've been thinking about that more and more lately, in the sense of why isn't this a tradition within our world of people seeking hyper sanity? As as a defense mechanism from all the insanity, you know, it's something that's been driving me lately. This idea of searching for the real, searching for the true, searching for that thing that is beyond any of the nonsense in my head about who I am as a person in time and place, but just that true, authentic experience of self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with that transcends language, that transcends even the words that we have in our head that we use to narrate our daily lives. You know, I want to transcend all of that and looking for that as a anecdote for, you know, or antidote, not anecdote, but antidote for, you know, modern American life and the pain and fear that we all have. Very difficult place, very difficult and interesting time to be alive. Yeah.
It is. But you know, I'm not so sure that tradition doesn't exist.
Well, I think it does, yeah. But I'm saying we don't have it exists in the sense of it exists in Buddhism, it exists in Taoism, it exists in Sufism, it exists in real hardcore yogic practitioners. But it's not in the forefront.
Right.
I did some research earlier in this year on a piece I was doing on mindfulness, and I was blown away by the idea that mindfulness is an $11 billion global industry.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
$4 billion in America alone. And that represents a wide spectrum of industries, you know, but how come we have all this and we don't have this thread strung through there? Doesn't need to be at the top. It just could be, you know, number 10 on the list would be happy, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking for it, you know. That's Dave, you want to know where I'm going, that's where I'm going.
Okay. Well, you know, the addiction recovery thing, I mean, you know, the most widely accepted approach is, you know, it's a spiritual solution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. I stopped drinking when I was 23 years old. And, you know, that's how I stumbled into this business. But, one of the things, and I see it as a blessing, that I was able to identify as a young adult is that, you know, my life doesn't mean anything. I don't feel a sense of meaning and purpose in my life. And that's not good. And I wanted that. And I kind of knew that in some way that was the answer, you know, that I needed to have meaning. I needed to have a sense of purpose.
Isn't that the existential crisis of the 20th century? Yeah,
you know. Well, and, you know, really, that's what I think addiction is. I think it's an existential crisis. Mm. You know, I think it is an expression of human suffering. You know, it's a way for a person to try to manage their suffering. And, you know, a lot of times, I mean, it's complicated all the more because people don't even know that suffering exists in the first place. You know, I think if we had a little bit better handle on all that, as a society, it wouldn't be so. But, you know, it drives me crazy, you know, this whole opioid crisis thing where, I mean, of course, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, the health insurance industry, there are all these factors, that are problematic. Mm. And, you know, recovery is a solution one at a time for a person. But what are we doing? Why are we, you know, what is it? Who's going to come up with, when are we going to really address the problem? That there's a hole that we're trying to fill that, you know, it's a God-shaped hole, you know? And, you know, for lack of a better label, I guess. But, you know, when are we going to figure out that we're off track as a culture when this many of our people are, you know, killing themselves slowly. Even if you look at nicotine addiction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, and you know, I don't know your stance on, alcohol. I mean, most people drink some and, you know, I'm not someone who thinks people shouldn't, but you know, it is the most dangerous drug. You know, it is the drug in our culture that kills the most people, but it's also the most acceptable one to consume.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. It's the one that's prescribed. It's the one that's most acceptable. I mean, yeah, the amount of alcohol I drink in a year could be counted on one hand.
Yeah. Honestly.
You know, it. You know, I mean, it's one of the reasons maybe I've gravitated over the years to Zen and Taoism particularly. Self-restraint is one of the primary behavioral identities
right. For
both religions. You know, the idea of, you know, understanding something and understanding what, I think it's a battle. My family has had substance abuse problems as well. I lucked out in the sense that I don't know if I was inoculated by watching everybody else or, you know, what the mechanism was, but I never suffered from that, knock on wood. But, you know, I mean, it destroys families, it destroys people, and you're right, it does come down to a great sense of, you know, it fills the emptiness that we don't fill ourselves.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, a big part of it is also, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with the idea of codependency. But the concept of finding your value outside of yourself, assigning your value as a human being outside of yourself. You know, that's kind of all of it. And, you know, some of the symptoms of it include, you know, an inability to experience reality, an inability to adequately express your wants and needs. You know, so we do things to appease other people rather than what is in our hearts. You know, back to the idea of how we spend our lives and how we spend our time and all that. I mean, it's beyond just substance abuse and addiction. I mean, there's codependence like all through the society where, you know, I mean, I have friends who, you know, there's one person who comes to mind who is just an overachiever. She does this, that. She's got businesses. She's got jobs. She's got, you know, I mean, very successful person. But I think if you stopped her and asked her why she's doing all this, she couldn't give you a clear answer.
No, she's being allowing herself to be defined externally.
Right.
And
that happens all the time. You know, we're doing it all the time. And then we distract ourselves with TV or Facebook or whatever it is, but
go on Facebook, social acceptance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just the distraction factor, you know, back to the suffering, we have all these distractions from our suffering that, you know, I mean, there's a lot to be said for experiencing the suffering because then you know something has to change. You know, when you're in pain, you have to do something. But if you're distracting yourself from it, avoiding it enough that you can withstand it, and then nothing ever changes.
Exactly. It's the idea of pain and suffering in that Buddhist sense. I remember one of my early Buddhist teachers telling me that the idea of suffering is so pervasive that even the air you breathe oxidizes your skin. You know, like, so even the air we breathe is caustic.
Right. Know?
And that's the idea of this encompassed, you know, idea that we're all suffering. I have found over the years that, that idea of, you know, codependence, of seeking some sense of identity, standing of myself in relationship to others, never led to any sense of authenticity. You know, a lot of people I've heard talk about cultivating authenticity. I'm not really sure you can do that. I honestly believe it's more about releasing yourself from conformity, conforming to the ideas that make you say that I need to numb the pain, the ideas that make you say I need to achieve X in order to have worth. You know, you need to release yourself from that in order to find your own true authenticity. To see what you are truly about, you have to let go of everything around you. It was one of the reasons why communities during the time of Gautama Buddha referred to him as the stealer of sons, because he would come and speak these things and kids would give up their family lives and their positions, and they'd give up, you know, their responsibility to the culture to go and follow him to a more authentic path to self. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, unfortunately, I've been waiting. I don't know when the next big Buddha arrives. Yeah, I think Thich Nhat Hanh is probably the best Buddhist writer we have on the planet right now. Even the Dalai Lama says he's enlightened.
Yeah. Well, I thought when you mentioned mindfulness earlier, I thought of him. And yeah, I mean, I have several books of his laying around. You know, it's very accessible too. That's one of the things I like about his writing.
If you get the chance, go hear him speak if he comes to the U.S. again. One of the things that amazed me about hearing him was that he speaks exactly like his books.
Really?
You're listening to him, and it sounds like he's narrating his own book. It is pretty wild. Many writers struggle to find or to capture their own voice, and his is just – he does it so naturally. Mm. And given that he's writing in a second language, it's even more amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, to me as a writer, one of the things that I try to do is, in terms of being authentic is, you know, I try to write fairly conversationally. And if I, if I reread something and think, I probably wouldn't use that word if I was speaking it, I'm probably going to edit it out, that's something I aspire to, is to sound the way that I, or read the way that I sound. Wow. This has been great. I've really enjoyed talking to you. And, we've touched on where you're going next. You have a big one to tackle. And, I've loved hearing the process of, how you conceived this book. It's obviously very, very well thought out, and, I'll make sure that, there are links in the show notes so that listeners can find your book. And also, you were kind enough to read some pieces for me, and I'll make at least some of those accessible as well. And you've been very, very gracious. If there's one thing that you would say to, someone the age of your stepsons, if there's one thing you could say to them about where they're going in life, what would you tell them at this point?
Wow. Interesting. Cause I actually put a quote in the book, or put a comment in the book for stepsons. I think I'm going to leave with that one. Cause it really sums up my feelings for everybody. So, inscribed the book to my stepsons, and I wrote, it's not about living your life looking for new possibilities. It's about living as if it were all possible. My boys, make your story worth your life. That's what I would leave it as. Make life worth, basically make your story worth your life. You're going to spend your whole life living it. So make it mean something. As we were talking before, this idea of meaning from outside, create the meaning that you want. When Gandhi says, be the change you want to see in the world, what he's saying is make yourself new. Make yourself what you want to be. Create yourself. Believe me, I've been through the roller coaster and the meat grinder of life, and I've redesigned myself a few times, and you can do it. You can do it consciously, or you can let the world sculpt you as you go, but either way it's going to happen, so better be conscious about it.
Right. Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'd love to stay in touch.
Yes, let's do. Let's grab coffee when I'm in Florida.
Okay, that'd be great. And I've spoken to a bookstore. I'm trying to work on something in my neck of the woods too, where maybe
Notes from the Drift, number 49. On a stretch of coastal prairie that swept its way down to the ocean, autumn found us camped out, far from the road, in the imagination of old, uncomplicated times. Lying on our backs with lovers and friends, tracing constellations in the simple clarity of moonlight, we talked, furiously, then drunkenly, of epiphanies and revelations. All variety of queer and fluid notions made their way into the sky. We questioned the memories and habits, society and its fantasies, and produced extended objections to the notion of a civilized man. In the sleepy pre-dawn, when only a few were awake, something approached from the tree line. Standing at the moonlit border, moving in and out of its steaming breath, we thought it a rogue coyote. Unrestrained, dark and irrational, it changed size and shape, never quite keeping to the story. Like some ancient trickster playing things we knew against things we imagined, it was hard to know how to behave. It was frightening and alluring, voluptuous in scope, hedonistic and extravagant in mood and desire. In soft whispers it spoke in what seemed like riddles or ripples, waves of infinite rhythm and chant. Hysterical and frenzied and yet soothing. Those who could not accept it or never understood just passed out, fell asleep, slipped into the tall grass still and quiet. When things are and are not, it is difficult to survive the demise of reason. It echoes into the self in intrinsic panic, the oldest shivers, marrow resonating. It can be difficult to accept that we are not the only citizens of the drift. Though the others can be reluctant neighbors, occasionally they do come out to greet us.
There you go, Anthony Guibert. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed it, please leave a rating or a review. Share it with someone who you know would like it. I want to thank the show's sponsor, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Thank you to the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Thank you to Anthony Guibert. Don't forget the January Journaling Challenge. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook, both at The Path to Authenticity. And as always, I'm all over Clubhouse. Wrapping up this 6-week series of talks on codependency, 7 p.m. Eastern on Sundays. So I appreciate you guys. I haven't really put out any new content for a couple weeks. With all this stuff going on with my family, the loss of my mom. So I appreciate your patience, and I appreciate you investing your time in this show. So thanks. Hope the holidays are shaping up well for you all. Lots of love. Be nice.
That's our story. I hope you enjoyed the punk rock opera. We have one last piece of music for you. It goes like this.
Okay, go. Just believe. generation of self-made bands. We cut our teeth with bloody hands. The rage that's instilled in us can feed a crowd.
Thank you. Good night.